Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the story. In 2006, a creaking slave ship full of bones hauls up out of the Hudson River at the feet of the Statue of Liberty. And New York City, mainly black New York City, but white too, goes into a fit of deep anger, attraction, revulsion, and remembrance. In a one-man show on in New York now, actor and writer Daniel Beatty plays 43 different characters whirling around the provocation of the ship and its bones, exploring the state of African-American freedom and memory, rich blacks, poor blacks, guilt-laden whites, and African chiefs all grappling with the remembrance now of what was then. Up next on Point, actor Daniel Beatty on a slave ship, remembrance and African-American responses today. Joining me now from New York is actor, singer, and writer Daniel Beatty. He's performing his one-man show, Emergency, at the Public Theater in New York. He's appeared on HBO's Russell Simmons Presents Deaf Poetry and is the 2004 Grand Slam champion at the New Eurekan Poets Cafe in New York. The Associated Press calls his one-man show electrifying, a lyrically brilliant must-see. Daniel Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I wish you'd take us straight in with a little montage from early in your show to get us in the groove with the slave ship at the feet of the Statue of Liberty and the city whirling around it. Can you go with that?
Certainly. It's appalling. It's a setback. In 2006, there are black people succeeding in every field. This is the last thing we need. I work in corporate America around the corner from here, and one of my colleagues just came into my office in tears after hearing the news on the radio. She tells me she has papers that prove her great-great-grandparents owned slaves, and she wants to apologize. And I said, "Why are you apologizing to me, Kathy? It was your great-great-grandparents," and she's hysterical. So I said, "Look at me, Kathy. You've been to my home. Our children play together. Look at this office. Kathy, I'm your boss." I moved here from Nigeria with my wife and two children. I grew up in Africa during the time of the civil rights movement here in America. We looked to black America as inspiration as we fought for independence at home. And 40 years later, we are still looking, but the picture is much different. Do you know there are gangs, Crips and Bloods in Nigeria? This is exactly why I never watch those damn PBS specials or talk about slavery with my children. It just pisses me off. And what am I supposed to do with the anger? How will this story unfold? Stay tuned for further details.
Daniel Beatty with a quick and right away we begin to get it montage from his one-man show, Emergency. It's at the Public Theater in New York. And Daniel Beatty, I saw a big chunk of this, 90 minutes on DVD that I was lucky enough to see. And holy moly, what a rocket ride. 43 characters nonstop. You just never quit. And it's all whirling around this narrative conceit of a slave ship emerging right here. 90 minutes and 43 characters. How do you do it? How did you design this sort of gumbo that just doesn't quit?
Well, I feel passionately, Tom, about all of the ideas that I'm discussing in the piece. I'm passionate about the state of America's race relations, the state of our freedom personally and as a society across race and class. And so that passion, that desire I have to speak to what I see going on in the world is what fuels me.
It's not a simple story. It's not the old woe and guilt. I love the bit that you just began with right there, where you've got the guilt-ridden white Kathy and her black colleague who has to say at the end of the day, "Kathy, settle down. I'm your boss." The world is more complicated than it is in storybook versions of race and race relations. You're really trying to dig into that. Give us a sense of the range of characters and perspectives that you present here.
Well, you know, I play everything from a homeless man on the street to young people who live in the projects to a Republican who has a traditional Republican view, perhaps, of race in the beginning, but then flips the switch on us to people who work in corporate America. I try to really give varying pictures. I play an older grandmother.
I really want to give as full a picture possible of the different voices in the African-American community around this experience.
At the heart of the story that weaves through all these voices is one family, two sons and a father. Give us a sense of the role they play in Emergency, Daniel Beatty.
Definitely. So the play opens with one of the sons looking for his father, who actually lives with him. And we discover early on in the play that the father actually is dealing with some type of mental illness and has had to move in with his son because of it. And the son has been looking all over Harlem, New York, trying to find out where his father is, and he can't find him. Then he gets a call, and his brother tells him to turn on the TV, and they discover that their father has gotten to Liberty Island and climbed on top of the slave ship that has risen out of the Hudson River. And when the father is on top of the slave ship, he has a conversation with the 400-year-old ancestor. And we discover through the course of the play that the young son's mother was killed, and the father took the death very heavily, and this ancestor has come to connect the father's personal pain of losing his wife and having to raise his sons without a mother with the collective loss and pain of the African-American people in this country. And a message in a story that is constantly being told in the play is that when we can remember things that have happened in our past, in our collective past that have been painful, in our personal past, we can see them clearly and perhaps make something beautiful and empowering out of them. And that's the main reason why I feel Emergency, the title of the play, is different than so many stories about race and about slavery, is that we are looking at slavery as a place of empowerment, as a place of something to look at honestly so that we can create a better future and collectively heal.
We didn't talk about this before, but you're so fluid in this. Could you give us a bit of that conversation between the father who swims out to the ship and the African ancestor as encountered in your one-man show?
Yes, certainly.
Come, come home to the truth of who we are.
Professor Reginald Johnson, you think you've got it all figured out.
Excuse me?
You think you know everything, Mr. Professor. How can you deny my existence, telling your sons to forget the past? Who are you? What is this? I am the you have denied. Your pain does not give you a right to deny me. What do you know about my pain? Your wife, Margaret, don't you dare mention her name. I am Chief Kofi, leader of the captured Africans who rode aboard this slave ship, Remembrance, from the depths of the Hudson River. I brought this slave ship full of the bones of your ancestors.
There, the chief upbraids the Professor Reginald Johnson, the father who swims out to the slave ship at the feet of the Statue of Liberty. And instantly, he's in this whirling world Daniel Beatty has created in the one-man show, Emergency. You make it very clear that there's no one African-American life in the arc of this show. You've got 43, and the suggestion is there could be many times that many voices brought in. You seem to endlessly kind of channel them here. But is there an overarching critique or line of empathy into that African-American experience that you're writing here? The chief, you quote right there, is critical of Reginald Johnson for not keeping his own sons connected to their history. What are you saying?
The message that I feel is one which you've already mentioned, is that the African-American community, as any community, has so many different voices. And that's the beauty of being human, and that we can all have different perspectives and make different choices for our lives. One thing that I do feel is that, particularly with the African-American community in America, there has been a sense of collective consciousness that has helped us through major points in our community. The periods of slavery, the periods of Jim Crow, the periods of civil rights. And I've worked as an educator. I grew up in a community where I saw the results, contemporary results of slavery being manifest even in my family. And I know that there are still many, many issues that need to be addressed. But we're in a society in general, I would say, but also in the African-American community, of people just doing their best to get by for themselves. And this spirit of collective thinking, of collective consciousness, I feel is much less. And that is very dangerous, particularly for our young people, because they don't know necessarily the story of slavery or civil rights. They don't know the story of that collective overcoming. And we have a whole segment of society of disenfranchised young people who desperately need a community to gather behind them and give them a sense of hope and possibility for the future.
Anthony's calling from Jamaica Plain in Massachusetts. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, Mr. Beatty, for this thank wonderful you. Play. I'm a former New Yorker, was born and raised in New York City. I was a tenant of a housing project. I'm Latino. I'm an attorney. And I'm the father of a Native American son. And I think it's interesting because a good percentage of my discussion of slavery and what was done to Native Americans in this country is met by, forget the past. Why do you always bring this up? Let's forget about it and move on. And I think that history has shown that that's very dangerous. It's dangerous not only to the youth of those particular cultures, but I think it's also dangerous for the dominant class that wants to not be held responsible for what has happened. And even in certain crimes, like, for example, rape, the system wants that particular person to be held responsible and to admit that something wrong happened. And only then can we move on. And I think that this play is making the dominant class look at what happened so that we can truly heal.
Anthony, now, hang on. Daniel Beatty, what do you say to our caller? Latino attorney says, look, when crimes occur, there's accountability. What about here?
I really feel deeply what he's communicating, and I think that that really is a part of the message. And the accountability is collective, and that's one of the things that I'm constantly saying, because it's the dominant culture's accountability or sensitivity or awareness about being willing to speak truthfully about what happened. But it's also exactly what he was saying about the culture that has had the experience being accountable for passing on the story and making sure our children know the story, because that responsibility lies with us. And, you know, when I think of accountability, what I mainly think about is a sensitivity, an awareness, a compassion.
But we sort of heard you making fun of the white office worker, Kathy, when she was, you know, you've got her kind of nattering on about how she owns slaves and what on earth should she do.
Right. Well, that's one of the characters' perspective. Another character would be deeply moved that Kathy feels that way and would sit down with her and speak with her very sincerely about her feelings.
Anthony, thanks for your call. Daniel Beatty, stand by. I want to go right now to a very special voice joining us. Ruby Dee, the revered African-American actress, been in more than 20 movies, first appeared on Broadway in 1943. Ruby Dee, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, really.
You saw Daniel Beatty early on in his bringing this one-man show to New York. What did you make of it? How did it strike
yes.
you?
Oh, yes, I saw him. Well, I wouldn't say early on in this phase of it, because as you may know by now, his is the kind of show that it comes from. There's a richness there that the time and experience and the personality bring into a kind of eternal quality, or it's you can't think of it. I can't think of it as having a beginning. You know, if you know what I'm saying, it comes from now. It comes from history. It comes from it even points to a future. You know.
Yes, we hear and see all that. You were married for more than 50 years to Ossie Davis, the great actor.
Yeah, well, we were married 56 years.
And we're sorry for
58 years. I forget.
We're sorry for your loss of him not so long ago. But you and Ossie Davis were both so instrumental in opening doors for black performers in America. Is this what you hoped, expected, would eventually walk through those doors?
Well, yes, and not in any very conscious way. Being part of the scene, you grow up in a kind of consciousness that is not deliberate. You don't decide that I will. But Daniel is a performer. Is the kind of thing that we so satisfied with when we see it and when we witness the level of this kind of talent, and also intelligence because he, and awareness because he's written all this material, and we know where the great people, where the great voices in the future come from, future as entertainers and as thinkers, and so I feel privileged in a sense to witness this young, young ancient.
Young ancient, Daniel Beatty, that's pretty high praise. What has it meant to you to have Ruby Dee reach out with this kind of encouragement for your work, Daniel Beatty?
I can tell you, once I have had the encouragement of Miss Ruby Dee and of Mr. Davis, there's really not another voice of affirmation that I need, because in my mind, these two beautiful human beings epitomize the artist activist and what that means. And I often say that Ruby Dee has been my angel, and she's just wrapped me in her wings. And when I've been discouraged, she has brilliant words of wisdom to encourage me. And she believes deeply in the message that I'm telling. And that is the greatest support, encouragement that I could ever have.
Oh, Daniel, I think, you know, it's universally acknowledged that this is an extraordinary talent and presence on the scene in theater, and we hope film and for many years to come. Many people have said it. I mean, I don't even want to claim credit. I just went kind of. It was a deeply satisfying experience. It always is when you come upon somebody that excites you in unexpected ways in terms of what they do. Mm. And this is what Daniel has done. Mm. As a singer, it's an extraordinary voice. as a writer, as an actor, as a thinker. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yes, we do.
Yes, and I don't even take credit because it's sort of there. My only wonder is that he has time to be on the radio.
it's our pleasure to have him in a terrific.
You understand, because I feel he's the kind of talent that's going to. At some point in our lives, to touch everybody who's interested in this kind of work.
Actress and icon, Ruby Dee, it's a real honor to have you drop in with us. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes today.
Yes,
thank you.
My delight.
Ruby Dee, wonderful to have you. Thanks so much. Thank you so much for coming by. Daniel Beatty, pretty high praise from somebody who's way up there on the ladder. My goodness. I want to get into your personal story a little bit, if we may. What informs
Certainly.
That thinking, that young ancient sensibility that Ruby Dee points to there? You mentioned earlier that the contemporary results of slavery, as you see it, are still hitting your own family. How? What do you mean?
Well, you know... And this is when I say that our collective understanding of the slave experience creates a possibility for greater compassion. It's not about excuses, but it's about really being honest. And, you know, many scholars talk about it, like Dr. Joyce Leary, the post-traumatic slave syndrome, or W.E. Du Bois and the concept of collective of double consciousness. Mm. But what I'm speaking about specifically is that there are many things that happened during slavery, like the separation from an authentic spiritual experience, the breakdown of the family, self-loathing, inner division within community. All of these things have happened. And when you see the contemporary experience of many African Americans, you can see that experience mirrored. And in particular, in my personal family life, I had a father who suffered from heroin addiction and was in and out of prison my whole life. I had a brother who also dealt with addiction. And I had a mother who was a single parent really trying to put all of these pieces together for herself. And I know that I had to make a choice whether or not I was going to be like the examples of men in my life or whether or not I was going to be something different. And a big part of my ability to make a different choice was for me to see clearly how they had become the men they had become. Mm. Yes, it was a product of personal choices that they made or did not make, and it was also a product of what they had grown up with and experienced. My father was a brilliant man who was also a very angry man. And in me healing that relationship, visiting him in prison and so forth, he told me stories of being a young boy in the South and seeing his father beaten by a white store owner who thought he was stealing something that he did not steal. Mm-hmm. And what it felt like for him as a young black boy to see this man who was his father, his hero, not be respected, and how that immediately linked to the life he'd made for himself.
That vacuum in your life, but lucky for you to have a mother who supported you and a talent that pulled you right up on from Dayton, Ohio, off to Yale, and now they're in New York. There's a great piece in the story, the Knock Knock piece, where a young boy in circumstances, I guess, very much like your own here, describes a relationship with a father, a black father, going off to prison. I wish you'd share that with us, Daniel Beatty.
Be my pleasure. As a boy, I shared a game with my father. We played it every morning till I was 3. He would knock-knock on my door, and I'd pretend to be asleep till he got right next to the bed. Then I would get up and jump into his arms. Good morning, Papa. And my papa, he would tell me that he loved me. We shared a game, knock, knock. Till that day when the knock never came, and my mama takes me on a ride past cornfields on this never-ending highway till we reach a place of high, rusty gates. A confused little boy, I enter the building, carried in my mama's arms, knock, knock. We reach a room of windows and brown faces. Behind one of the windows sits my father. I jump out of my mama's arms and run joyously towards my papa's, only to be confronted by this window. I knock, knock, trying to break through the glass, trying to get to my father. I knock, knock as my mama pulls me away before my papa even says a word. And for years, he has never said a word. And so 15 years later, I write these words for the little boy in me who still awaits his papa's knock. Papa, come home, because I miss you. Miss you waking me up in the morning and telling me you love me. Papa, come home, because there's things I don't know, and I thought maybe you could teach me how to shave, how to dribble a ball, how to talk to a lady, how to walk like a man. Papa, come home, because I decided a while back I want to be just like you, but I'm forgetting who you are. And 15 years later, a little boy cries, and so I write these words, and I try to heal, and I try to father myself, and I dream up a father who says the words my father did not. Dear son, I'm sorry I never came home. For every lesson I failed to teach, hear these words. Shave in one direction with strong, deliberate strokes to avoid irritation. Dribble the page with the brilliance of your ballpoint pen. Walk like a child of God, and your goddess will come to you. No longer will I be there to knock on your doors. You must learn to knock for yourself. Knock, knock down doors of racism and poverty that I could not. Knock, knock on doors of opportunity for the lost brilliance of the black men who crowd these cells. Knock, knock with diligence for the sake of your children. Knock, knock for me, for as long as you are free, these prison gates cannot contain my spirit. The best of me still lives in you. Knock, knock with the knowledge that you are my son, but you are not my choices. Yes, we are our father's sons and daughters, but we are not their choices. For despite their absences, we are still here, still alive, still breathing, with the power to change this world, one little boy and girl at a time. Knock, knock. Who's there? We are.
Daniel Beatty in a powerful passage from his one-man show, Emergency, playing in New York. Now let's take a call from Robert in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well, sir.
Good. I do agree with your guest 100%. I'm 62 years old, mm-hmm. and I remember right back in 1955, I grew up in Georgia doing segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very well in 1955, my grandparents and some of my other relatives who were around 100 at that age, at that time, they gave me very disturbing examples of experiences they had, which coincided with the experience that I was having in Georgia at that time. Now, since then, I live in a predominantly white community in Amherst, where mm-hmm. Amherst College is a block from me, and mm-hmm. UMass is down the street. And I do a radio show in Northampton, which is about 2 miles from Smith College.
Good for you.
And it's centered around race. And I get the same kind of responses. Some say I'm teaching hate. Some say forget it, get over it. Or it didn't happen to you. They don't seem to make the connection between what happened to us historically and why we are in the positions that we are now.
So you're in a very liberal community there, but you get pushback against hearing too much about it. What do you make of that?
It's all denial, and you can't make them see it. And I was told by many black, a lot of black intellectuals out here, don't even try because they're not going to listen. But I thought perhaps I could get through to some people and at least create a dialogue It would be nice if the young man would bring his show out here. Maybe that would help.
Robert, stand by. Daniel, what do you say to our caller, Robert, who can't find an audience for too much of this?
Well, you know, what I would encourage people who say, forget it, let's move on, you weren't affected by it, to consider is the fact that our young people have not heard the story.
True.
And the ramifications of a generation who don't know their history and only have these pop cultural images on our BET or what's happened with so much of hip-hop as their models of who they are in the world, you know. And I just say, encourage you to just keep going and keep telling the story, you know. It's not always a popular message, but somebody is hearing it and somebody's got to tell it.
Laura's calling from Littleton, Massachusetts. Hi, Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, how are you?
Very well. What do you see, Laura?
Well, I'm actually raising three young kids, 8, 6, and 3. And at this point, they don't see the difference between people with when described as race or ethnicity. They just see everybody as different. And now my 8-year-old's coming upon the time where she's learning about stuff. And, for instance, you were just talking about Deval Patrick. I didn't want to say that he was the first black governor elected to Massachusetts because I didn't want her to see it as being, you know, different.
And only the second in the history of the United States, black governor anywhere.
Well, and I'm embarrassed by that, but at the other end, she doesn't see the difference. And I feel like when she learns about slavery, she's going to start thinking of people differently, where right now she just thinks of everybody as different. And I think it's so beautiful and pure, and I feel like I'm going to mess it up by teaching her, you know, the history.
Fascinating. Daniel Beatty, Laura's right there. What do you say to her?
You know, I think that's there's an example of the beauty of the complexity of what these issues are that we're facing. Because the reality is I can completely understand and sympathize with a mother's perspective and the protection that a parent feels for their child. The reality is the dynamics of race in this country are so thick and so deep that your daughter is going to encounter them. And there is a need to teach it because of the fact that there's a context for why so many African Americans are in the current economic, social conditions that they are. You know, there's just roots of what our experience in this country are that are like no other culture. And for your daughter, I believe, to have the type of compassion that I hear you expressing in her voice, in your voice, she's going to have truthful awareness of what the history of race in this country is so that she can look at the African Americans that she encounters from the appropriate lens.
Laura, what do you think? Maybe there's no way to have a year zero here, a completely clean slate, even with an 8-year-old child.
I guess I'm looking at, well, maybe that next generation could be pure and not see color and not see race and not see ethnicity and just see everybody as an individual who has different feelings or looks or hair or whatever. And that's how she looks at it right now. And I just, like I said, I want to push it as far off as I can until she, you know, is to learn about it, but already has a good, you know, feeling about it and a good background.
It's a beautiful idea and beautiful to hear you struggling with it the right time, the right way. Thanks very much for your call. Let me take a call from South Bombay, New York. Ralph is on the line. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing? And thank you for taking my call and providing this round table on this discussion, and I'm thrilled. I can't wait to say to Ruby D, Ralph Pointer, who in New York City, who tried to get plays brought to the school system, and I was told that Ozzy and Ruby were open to call them, and I made the phone call, and Ozzy answered the phone himself, and we discussed the project, and he agreed with it and said, get the space. I'm writing on plays right now, and let's put them in the public schools.
Sounds like you're still ready to chew on Ruby D's leg, but what do you think about Daniel Beatty's project here,
I think
Ralph?
It's wonderful because no matter what you say about it, this history of Africans in America has been so neglected that any light you show on it, from the bottom, from the top, from the liberal, from the conservative, from the racist, it is light that's necessary. Thank you, Daniel, and we will be working to bring groups to the theater to see you, and I'm going to introduce myself when I get there.
That's
this
terrific.
Is wonderful to hear. Thank you again, Daniel.
Thank you so much.
Ralph, thanks so much for your call. Daniel, let me get one more. Hassam is calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Hassam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am from West Africa, and when I came here, we came to discover that the way that we have perceived African-American here, that's not the way they're living. And somehow we have a sense of guilt among us in among us that we kind of like sold our brothers and they were brought here and they like kind of suffering. I don't know if your guest could like elaborate on that.
A West African, Daniel, saying he carries some guilt. But let me ask you first, Assam, if I may, you said that your expectations of what you would find among African Americans are not what you found is not what you expected. What do you mean by that exactly?
Actually, the way they're living, when we in Africa there, we kind of like have this mentality of prosperity and all kind of happiness that they're living. But when you come here, you find racism and all kind of stuff that when you encounter your brothers, you don't have that sense of happiness. You don't see that.
Daniel Beatty, you cross this line between African-Americans and straight-up Africans in the show. What do you say to Hassam?
How complex, again, is the message that he is communicating? And it's just so profound. I actually have a lot of emotion coming up in me as I hear it. And what I would say to that is that in my journeys to Africa, I know in Ghana there's this word, Akwaba, and it's the spirit of your welcome. And there's something beautiful about the African culture, even the African-American culture, which is the spirit of welcome. And when the people came who ended up being the slave masters who took us from our motherland, the concept of slavery in Africa was so different than the nightmare of what American slavery was. There was no concept, you know, when these brothers and sisters were being sold away, that this is the experience that they were being sold into.
But it was slavery, and they knew that. And we've seen
right,
the pictures. You've been at the departure point. What about the guilt Hassam points to? He says he feels, and his brothers, as he puts it, feel some guilt about having sold a whole population across the sea.
Well, you know, that's real. You know, that's a real part of the healing, and that's the real part of the conversation that has to happen. But what I say when I rise the slave ship, a grandmother says in the show, the slave ship is not about guilt. It's about healing, about where do we go from here for ourselves and for our children. Because there, you know, I understand him saying that there is guilt about the Africans having sold, but there's a whole other side of that in terms of what has happened with the rape and pillage of Africa. There's a collective need to reach across the Middle Passage, you know, reach across Europe and the countries that colonized and join hands and join hearts and join minds and heal these issues. Mm. You know, many people have reason for guilt. That's my real response.
You turn this experience, this jewel, again and again. So many facets show up here. The complexity you talk about comes across again and again. There's a passage where a successful African-American is driving along in his BMW, maybe the kind who might be embarrassed to think back on all this or to find it a kind of a nuisance to think back. He's doing fine, thank you. But you convey in a passage here about the anger that he carries with him. He's pulled over by a policeman in a sort of frenzy around the ship at the Statue of Liberty, reaches for his ID with trepidation, fearing that the policeman may imagine him reaching for a gun, and then his own imagination kicks in. I wish you'd share some of that with us, Daniel Beatty.
Certainly. This man who gets stopped is actually the father's, who climbs on top of the ship's son. Mm-hmm. And so he's actually on his way to get his father off the slave ship when he gets stopped by a cop. And this is the scene. Excuse me? Oh, yes, officer, my ID. I'll get it. My ID is in my left-hand pocket. I'll get it. Bang! You don't know me. Man, I live on this block, third house on the right. Come over for dinner sometime. Fried chicken and caviar. I've got a college degree making $100,000 a year, and folks still want to stop me in my Beamer thinking I'm a drug dealer. I don't have time for this, man. I'm over it. I'm seeking liberty at any cost and offering it to everybody who enters my realm. That cop thought he was a bigoted authority figure who was going to ruin my day. Bang! I just freed his mind. No buy or this kumbaya, my lord, we shall overcome stuff. Just bang! So when my Beamer's in the shop and a cabbie passing me by on the street, hey, man, I'm already late. What, you think I won't tip? Here's one. Bang! You don't know me. When a woman clenches her purse and crosses the street, actually, ma'am, Coach is not my brand. I prefer Hermes. Bang! You don't know me. When a clerk follows me through the store at Macy's, what are you looking at? I'll buy this other coat and your minimum wage job. Bang! You don't know me. When my divinity is deemed dirty, bang! When they call my anger the black man's disease, bang! When they silence, deny, and reject my voice, bang, bang, bang! Oh, hell no! Excuse me. Oh, yes, officer. My ID.
My ID is in my left-hand pocket. I'll get it. Here it is.
Daniel Beatty, in a passage from his one-man show, Emergency, the bangs are in the imagination of a very angry man on his way to try and coax his father off an imagined slave ship in the Hudson River. What about that anger and the spectrum from anger to solace? What's the solace to that kind of anger, even in the most, or at least quite, successful black man 2006 in America? What's the solace?
You know, there's a passage in the play that talks about having to love each other back to wholeness. But I believe before we can get to love, we have to be honest about what is. And so that is my response. Rage is real. Deep grief is real. Guilt is real. Confusion is real. These are all feelings, the complexities of feelings that come up when we discuss the history of race in this country. And what I endeavor to do in Emergency at the Public Theater is that I endeavor to have 43 different characters speak honestly from their hearts about what they're fighting to communicate, what they're fighting to be, how they want to be free in the world. And by seeing their honest feelings about it, we can get to a place of love.
Mary's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Mary. You're on the air with Daniel Beatty.
Thank you for taking my call. I have some comments to make.
Please.
I travel extensively, and like in places like in Gambia, Senegal, Egypt, even in Peru, as an Afro-American, I'm always asked the question of how I feel about slavery. And I'm asked this question where the others on my tour are not asked this question,
mm-hmm.
because people really want to know how I feel about it. And one of the things I tell them, and I will tell you, is that it has not been acknowledged to say it was wrong and I'm sorry. I think that would be the first point. And I have to tell people in these places that as a Christian, you have to do that. You have to acknowledge it. You have to say, I'm sorry. And that would be one way of starting the healing. When you go to Gambia and you see, it might have been in Senegal, where you see where the slaves were kept, it was just so emotional. Until you have to lie down.
But Mary,
we have to acknowledge that first.
But let me ask you,
I would like to see your play, but mm-hmm. I'm leaving in about a week for Greece and Turkey. So I might miss it, and I would like to get some information about it. I'm trying to comment on everything. I'm sorry. And I enjoy this kind of programming. I'm at the office, but I enjoy this kind of program, and that's why I will always support the station.
Mary, but when do you want to hear this conversation? Do you want fellow citizens, white Americans, you know, every time you turn around to be apologizing for slavery, or is there a point?
You have to acknowledge it first, that it existed, it was heinous, and that you're sorry.
So, and I think what she's saying about the government.
You're not moving ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mary, we've got it. We appreciate you being there as a listener. Daniel Beatty, what about it? You know, every other second? I mean, because you're also portraying black Americans here who want to live in some dimensions free of that, or to acknowledge it but also live beyond it. Where's the right balance here?
Well, my clear message, you know, I try to, like I said, provide as many perspectives as possible because that's real. And ultimately, I'm creating a dialogue, which I feel an artist has an obligation to do, hold a mirror to society, as Shakespeare would say. But I most definitely feel that we must remember. We must remember for our collective healing, and we must remember for the sake of our children. And some type of true commemoration of what the slavery experience was in our country is necessary.
Can you give us one more bit from Emergency Peter, the young man who lives in the projects and aspires to get out? We've just got a couple of minutes here.
Great.
Clarissa's my girlfriend, and she's the bomb. We have a lot in common because we're both smart. We make too much noise in class. Our teacher, she gets so upset. She bangs her ruler against her desk, and she yells, I am not impressed. I am not impressed. And Clarissa always whispers in my ear. That's what she says to her husband when they're having sex. I am not impressed. She be cracking me up. Clarissa and I aren't going to have sex, but we're going to live together forever, and I'm going to be an opera singer. I sing with the Harlem Boys Choir. And it is off a hook, because it's almost like I get to be two different people. It's like I live in the projects and there's trash everywhere, but then I sing with the choir and we go to all these beautiful places and everything is different. Like once, we took this trip all the way to Africa to sing at this festival where all these black people from all over the world came to remember slavery, and it was awesome. And our director, Dr. Turnbull, he asked me to sing the solo. And after we lit a bunch of candles and walked all the way through the whole village, we finally made it to the Cape Coast slave dungeons. And it was this big, huge white castle. And there were like a million gazillion black people there. And I was mad nervous. But then I sang, Lord, how come me here? I wish I never was born. And it was so sad. And that's kind of like how I felt when I just heard about the slave ship. It's kind of like I just wish we were all the same color and we all talked the same and that God didn't make us all so different on the outside. Because it's almost like it's a trick to make us think we're more different than we are. And everybody keeps getting fooled. That's whack. You know, sometimes I forget I'm black. Like I'm singing somewhere with the choir, or I'm shopping with moms, and I'm not thinking about being black. I'm just being me. But it seems like somebody else always remembers. Dr. Turnbull, he tells us we sing a song of hope. And even though a drug dealer or a prostitute might live on our corner, we can still be anything we want. And it's like, even though I live where I live, because of the choir, I know there's places where I can go. And I'm going to take Clarissa with me.
Daniel Beatty from his one-man show, Emergency. It's at the Public Theater in New York. Has it brought your own family back together, Daniel?
You know, I've been working very hard to heal relationships in my family. My mother has been an avid supporter, and she came out to see the show. I worked to heal the relationship with my father, and we had some success. And then, you know, that relationship, because of his relationship with addiction, deteriorated again. And I use the truth of that, and I speak the truth of that, because it's the truth of the situation. You know, many of us are succeeding. Thank God for our Barack Obamas and our Deval Patricks. And there is also the projects. There is also a huge segment of our society that is disenfranchised and without hope. And much of that segment of society includes our children.
43 characters in a very complex one-man show that we're honored to have had you share with us today. Young Ancient, as Ruby Dee told us right here. Daniel Beatty, the show is Emergency at New York's Public Theater. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.